Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Mati Friedman. I'm a board member of the Yeshiva University Student Medical Ethics Society, and I'll be moderating this session entitled The Male Side of the Story, Sperm Retrieval and Male Infertility. As stated in the title, this session will be discussing fertility issues related to the male. The discussion will primarily focus on the process of sperm retrieval and analysis and the respective halakhic implications. We have the privilege this afternoon of having with us two expert panelists to present this topic, Rabbi Yaakov Neuberger and Dr. Scott Chudnoff. Rabbi Neuberger currently holds the position of Rosh Yeshiva at the Major School of Talmudic Studies, as well as serving as the spiritual leader of Congregation Beit Avraham in Bergenfield, New Jersey. From 1986 to 1990, he had the distinction of being the first spiritual leader of the Jewish community at Yeshiva University's Albert Einstein College of Medicine and the Jack D. Weiler Hospital. Rabbi Neuberger is a graduate of Yeshiva College and receives both his smicha and his yadin yadin ordinations from Yeshiva University's Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. Rabbi Neuberger also holds a master's degree in psychology from Columbia University. Dr. Chudnoff received his MD from the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. Following this, he completed his residency in obstetrics and gynecology and his fellowship in minimally invasive pelvic surgery at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Dr. Chudnoff is currently an attending obstetrician-gynecologist at the Montefiore Medical Center of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, as well as a professor of obstetrics and gynecology and women's health at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Finally, I'd like to note that time has been allotted at the end of the session for Rabbi Neuberger and Dr. Chudnoff to take questions. Therefore, I would like to ask that everyone please hold all questions until both speakers have finished their presentation. Now, without any further ado, Dr. Scott Chudnoff.
Good afternoon, everyone. I just want to thank you for the opportunity to talk today about our topic on male infertility and sperm collection. As those of you who attended the plenary session, you saw that the fact that male infertility is really not just a minor area and aspect of the entire process, but it actually accounts for a very large percentage of the problems that lie with the infertility and the workup of the infertility. What we're going to try to do this afternoon, myself and Rav Neuberger, is to go over some of the issues and to try to address them in a more practical approach as they might be countered for both a patient and as whether you're a physician or a rabbi that would be potentially encountering these issues. And in order to do that, what I'm going to start with is a case presentation of a patient, an actual patient. The names have been changed to protect the innocent. Basically, this is a couple, Mr. and Mrs. J, who presented to my office with complaints of infertility. They had been married for 14 months and had been trying to conceive for approximately 14 months. When they had presented to the office, we had begun the initial workup. Now, as a matter of introduction, you might be saying, well, you're an OBGYN, why are you talking about male infertility? And I can tell you that in the majority of circumstances, it's a matter of practicality. Most men tend to not have physicians unless they're actually have some sort of medical problem, as opposed to women who, during their reproductive years, typically do have an OBGYN who they regularly see, and therefore it's usually the first person who is sought out in the care of and treatment for infertility problems. As a result of that, the OBGYN has taken on very much the role, particularly in the diagnosis and initial management of infertility, both relating to the male and the female, because essentially we have to treat both of them, the entire couple, not the individuals per se. So going further along in our case here, so we reviewed Mrs. J's history. And Mrs. J is a healthy 26-year-old female who came in with no significant problems. She had no real medical problems. She had no surgeries before. She's not taking any medications. And nothing in her history suggested that she should have any abnormalities related to ovulation, since her menstruations were normal in their duration, in their onset. And therefore, the question of whether or not there was actually any type of fertility issue related directly to her was somewhat limited. Additionally, the original lab work that had been done had shown no evidence of any hormonal abnormalities. Our physical exam on her also showed no abnormalities that would be apparent from the external examination and the pelvic examination, which is routine. Mr. J also a healthy 27-year-old male who had no real significant history. He did report a history of a hernia repair surgery, and he doesn't really take any medication except for the occasional antihistamine. Really no reason directly that we would expect or understand why there should be any direct infertility related from either of the parties involved. So as was mentioned previously in the plenary session, you know, the contribution of who and where the infertility is stemming from is really an even split. Between 35 to 40% of cases of infertility come from the male partner, and 35 to 40% come from the female. The remaining are basically unknown. You know, our level of science and our knowledge hasn't really progressed to that point where we really are capable of understanding everything yet. Hopefully, as the science progresses, we'll get a better understanding of these things. So some of the objectives that I'm going to try to do, and we're going to go relatively quickly because I know that we have a lot to cover and we don't have that much time, is some of the male reproductive biology. We're going to discuss some of the sources of male infertility, explain how male infertility is diagnosed, and explain different methods of semen collection. What I'm not going to do is I'm not going to discuss the halachic implications, and that's why we have Rav Neuberger over here, because as a physician, and part of what I think the entire purpose of this conference is also to see how the interplay between the physician and the Rav can go for the treatment of the couple that would be facing these issues. So just a real quick review of anatomy. So the external genitalia, as you see over here, the shaft of the penis, the thing that I want to point out that's important is the scrotum. And the thing that people don't necessarily realize is that the scrotum is actually an organ in and of itself that actually moves. The purpose of the scrotum is to provide the environment for the testes to be an optimal temperature. And the temperature needs to be less than what is normally inside the body for normal sperm production to occur. If the temperature is too high, then normal sperm production will not occur. And the testes are able to descend and ascend depending on the current temperature that the person is exposed to. In terms of the internal anatomy, and the things that I'm really not going to discuss right now are the kidneys, which are located over here, and the ureters, which carry the urine down to the bladder. What we're going to discuss is basically from the testes all the way through the system out to the penis. And the reason why this is important is because an understanding of the anatomy can really help us and has helped us currently in medicine understand a better reason why infertility exists at various different parts. So the testes are basically an organ. The primary purpose of the testes is the production of sperm and also of certain hormones that are important for male characteristics and reproduction. The epididymis lies next to the testes, and it's an organ that is located, as you can see, I'm sorry, my pointer wasn't working this morning, right over here. And this is basically as the sperm are produced from the testes, they then subsequently progress into the epididymis. The epididymis has various different portions of it, and it's in the epididymis where they wait until they're recruited at the time of ejaculation. From the epididymis, the testes, the epididymis then attaches to a tube known as the vas deferens. The vas deferens is the tube which connects the epididymis out to the, basically going all the way to the urethra with some stops along the way. The seminal vesicles are these glands that are located right before the vas deferens starts to enter into the prostate gland. And it really contributes the majority of the fluid that's produced in the seminal fluid. What's important that I'll mention here and I'll restate again later is the fact that seminal fluid is different than semen. Semen is contained in seminal fluid, but the majority of what's in seminal fluid is not semen. And I'll get into that a little bit. Moving along, after you pass through the seminiferous tubules, you hit the prostate gland, and the prostate gland, as many people know, is the cause of many problems for cancer and hypertrophy later on in life. It can cause various urinary problems. And piercing through the prostate gland is both the urethra and the vas deferens as it goes through the prostate and then subsequently enters into the urethra. And this is where the connection happens, where there's a single connection and ultimately a single exit for both urine and seminal fluid, as opposed to a female where both of those are separate all the way through. I just mentioned this here, the bubble urethra, the Cowper's gland. It's really just a small gland, doesn't contribute that much other than what's known as pre-ejaculate fluid, and it basically serves as the pre-lubrication. However, it is thought to believe that some of the reasons why people could potentially get pregnant even without ejaculation could be because of semen that are still inside after a prior ejaculation. And then subsequently, the urethra. The urethra is at various different places, has different compositions. It starts at the bladder, and then it works its way down through the prostate. There's a membranous section where it then ultimately exits through the penis. So now that we have a basic understanding of the anatomy, where the sperm starts from and where it ends to, it's important for us to get a basic understanding of the physiology. Now, we always talk about hormones. Everyone has heard about hormones. I'm sure it's in our normal vernacular these days. But I think very few people actually truly understand what hormones are. Hormones are basically the body's communication system. It's pretty much similar to email. What it does is it sends out a message for various cells to subsequently pick up. When those cells pick up those messages, it starts to do some activity, whatever that activity may be, depending on the hormone and the cell that it's going to. Most of the most common things that hormones do is it basically tells things to start and tells things to stop. It can make things grow bigger, it could cause things to make new cells, and it can cause things to ultimately use more energy. So the most common case I could think of today of hormones, I think most of us know Barry Bonds. I think that without any explanation of the importance of how hormones plays in our popular culture today. So an understanding of the hormonal system and how it functions goes back to a functioning of the actual head itself, because hormones originate in the brain. The hormones that we're referring to specifically for our purposes here, there are multiple organs that do produce hormones, but the majority of hormonal control for the entire body originates in the head. And what you have here is a cross-section of a brain, and over here is the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is the section which really controls the highest level of control for hormones in the body. The hypothalamus will subsequently release hormones to the pituitary gland, if I can get this there, which is located right over here. The pituitary gland subsequently will release hormones, and the most common ones that we're going to be discussing today and have importance to us is something known as GnRH, which is released from the hypothalamus, which is known as gonadotropin-releasing hormone. And as it might seem, the gonadotropin-releasing hormone causes gonadotropins to be released. They are subsequently released from the pituitary gland, and the gonadotropins that we encounter typically are LH and FSH. Those hormones then subsequently go down and play a role on the testes and activate the testes to tell the testes to do various different things. They also have roles in other areas and other tissues in the body, but primarily we have what's known as the HPT axis, as it's known to, the hypothalamic pituitary testes axis, whereby most of the control in the hormones in the body run through. Now, when we talk about hormones, and particularly with male infertility, I think the king of all hormones is testosterone. And testosterone is the hormone that basically dictates all of the male characteristics that we typically associate with males, hair growth, sexual function, aggression, male pattern baldness. All of these things are associated with testosterone. It is really the primary sex hormone when we're concerned about hormonal control. And this is just, as you can see, all hormones essentially are related in a certain manner and way. As you can see over here, all hormones start from that ubiquitous structure known as cholesterol, the thing that we're all trying to lower and cut out of our diets. Well, it actually is fairly important and serves a pretty important role in our body. And ultimately, all hormones that are involved in sex in sexual function for both males and females have a similar pathway in which they go. And as you can see over here, testosterone is down over here. Estradiol, or estrogen, which is the primary female hormone, is right over here. And progesterone is right up over here. So there is an interrelation between all of these different hormones. Now, why is this all important? Well, ultimately, this all leads us to, and if I can get to this quickly, the functioning, the normal, of how do we normally get to a sperm cell. And let me see if this works here.
Is organized into a network of
I don't know why we're not getting video now.
Within
hold on
these
1 second.
Tubules, spermatogenesis occurs. Spermatogenesis is the production of mature haploid sperm cells through meiotic cell division.
If you give me a
spermatogonium
second here,
deep in the epithelium of the seminiferous tubules gives rise.
Give me 1 second.
This cell contains 46 chromosomes. A primary spermatocyte undergoes the first meiotic.
I'm sorry, a little technical difficulty here. Okay. Hopefully this will work. If not, we'll just skip it. And basically, what I just want to show you here is basically how the sperm cells are actually formed. And this little
the
video
testis
here.
Is organized into a network of seminiferous tubules. Within these tubules, spermatogenesis occurs. Spermatogenesis is the production of mature haploid sperm cells through meiotic cell division. A spermatogonium deep in the epithelium of the seminiferous tubules gives rise to a primary spermatocyte. This cell contains 46 chromosomes. A primary spermatocyte undergoes the first meiotic division, producing two identical secondary spermatocytes. Each secondary spermatocyte contains 23 chromosomes. The secondary spermatocytes complete meiosis, giving rise to haploid spermatids. Each spermatid contains 23 chromosomes. The spermatids then develop into mature sperm.
So, the primary reason why I showed you that is because what's important to understand, the whole purpose of what happens in the testes and sperm production is that to try to make a cell that's capable of fertilizing an egg. And what's happening there is it's basically taking the chromosomes and splitting them in half in order to make it be able to meet up with the other half, which would be from the female. So what's actually in the semen? Well, about a very small part of it actually comes from the testes itself, and that's the sperm itself. The spermatozoa. The seminal vesicles, like I mentioned before, are the primary contributors to the seminal fluid. And all of these things, the prostate gives approximately 25% of it. The bulbar urethral gland is a very small sliver. And the primary thing is this is giving up the entire makeup of what's inside the semen. The importance of this is because when we start to analyze and see what's going on, understanding the various components of it are going to give us a better understanding as to what's going on with the male, if there's any problems with the male. So in terms of testing and figuring out what's going on with the male, so the very basics of all medical testing begins with taking a good history and physical examination and looking for various different reasons for why there may be a problem, and basically looking at things that might potentially lead us to believe what the primary cause is. There are various other testing modalities, ultrasound, postcoital testing, semen analysis, testicular biopsy, and genetic testing. In terms of history, there's a lot of things that can happen to a man over the course of his lifetime in terms of infectious diseases, surgeries, various medical problems that could directly impact on why there may be an infertility problem. And the importance of understanding this is that by treating some of these medical conditions, it can, in certain circumstances, help overcome the infertility. A physical examination is really important because the physical examination will tell us whether or not the hormonal development is appropriate. It's not uncommon that someone should be born without a testicle or both testes, although that's less common and would probably be diagnosed at an earlier age, but it is not impossible for even in today's day and age for someone to go their entire life without realizing that there is an abnormality. And the various aspects of the exam will help us to differentiate whether or not there's appropriate development. There's something known as Tanner staging, where basically what we look for is to see whether or not there's appropriate hormonal development. And in order for someone to develop appropriately on their external genitalia, it would require the underlying hormones to be working and functioning properly. So I'm going to get a little bit into now on semen analysis, and I think semen analysis is really the crux of a lot of the issues that we're going to be dealing with today. Semen analysis is basically a method whereby we analyze the semen. And in the normal workup and evaluation, as was mentioned in the plenary session, if you were to just walk into a physician's office and complain of infertility, the first thing the doctor is going to recommend is a semen analysis. It's cheap, it's easy, it's quick, and it tells you a whole lot of information. Obviously, we have the halakhic implications, which may suddenly start to alter when semen analysis would, should, could come into play in our evaluation. And basically, in semen analysis, all we do is we collect a sample of semen, and I have available, we could pass around the room if anyone wants to see what it is. There's different ways in which we could collect the sample. The most common method used in general medicine is masturbation into a sterile cup. The use of a sterile condom, which basically has no spermicides, and what people often mistake is that they can just go to the store and buy a condom and use that for their semen analysis, and you can't do that. It can't be latex, and it can't have many of the chemicals that are typically found in condoms when you're doing that assessment and analysis. And basically, certain other issues can potentially come into play from a halakhic point of view relating to the timing of when doing a semen analysis. Patients should ideally abstain from ejaculation for at least 2 days, but no more than 7 days before providing the sample. And the ideal is that there should be some that there should be an ejaculation that happens about 2 days before the sample that's being tested. The sample needs to be delivered to the lab in less than 1 hour, so that creates certain issues related to where the specimen is going to be obtained and collected. If you live in Manhattan, even if you only live a few blocks away, sometimes it may be more than an hour to get to the lab. The sample needs to remain at body temperature. Basically what happens is once the specimen is brought, the specimen is prepared, and we allow it to basically liquefy. And we then go and look through various parameters in the semen itself to try to determine whether or not there's an abnormality. So the first thing we would easily measure is the semen volume and see how much is there. The volume itself can be a direct relationship to different problems related to the ducts themselves, as well as to the normal functioning. In someone who has a particularly low semen volume, there may be a concern of something known as retrograde ejaculation, where the ejaculate, rather than going out through the penis, can go subsequently backwards and into the bladder. And we can determine that through checking the urine. We would look at liquefaction time, which is the amount of time it takes for the semen. The semen, when it comes out, is pretty sticky, and then it will subsequently start to liquefy. We could look at sperm count, which is probably one of the most important parameters, to see how many sperm are actually there. What's considered normal? Well, approximately 20 million motile sperm is what's considered to be a normal amount in our semen analysis. We would look at sperm shape, and as you saw before, there's a normal shape to a sperm. You have the head over here, the midpiece, and then you have the tail section. And actually, all of those components are fairly critical in order to be able to achieve fertilization of an egg. We would look at sperm movement to see whether the semen is moving correctly forward and whether they're moving fast, slow, irregular, erratic. We would look at the pH of the semen. An abnormally high or low can cause the semen to be affected because it requires a very specific environment to live. We would look at white blood cells, as that would potentially indicate evidence of an infection, and fructose levels. Various other tests could potentially be done on the semen as well, cultures, antibody testing. There's a whole slew of additional tests that can be done depending on the circumstances and as they apply. One of the things that I think is important to touch upon, and again was mentioned previously in the plenary session, is the postcoital test. The postcoital test is basically an examination of the woman's mucus in the cervix, and it's examined after having had intercourse. The appropriate timing for this, which is actually fairly critical, and particularly when you're dealing with people who are not necessarily familiar with infertility, so a lot of generalists are unaware of the appropriate timing, and frequently if you don't have an office that's open 7 days a week, you may not have the opportunity to get in for the optimal timing for when this exam is done. And basically, it needs to be done about 1 to 2 days prior to ovulation because the mucus in the cervix changes on the woman. Basically, what happens is the couple has intercourse about 2 to 8 hours before the test is done. They present to the doctor's office, and the doctor takes a little specimen of the mucus, and that is subsequently looked at under the microscope. Well, what are some of the advantages? Well, it could determine if sperm are present. It could determine if sperm are moving. It may indicate if the cervical mucus has a problem, if it's too thick, if there's antibodies against the sperm, which, although does happen, is not as common as some people like to think it is. Some of the disadvantages, well, it doesn't prove anything, okay? So if there's sperm there, that doesn't mean that his count is adequate. If they're moving, it doesn't mean that they're all moving. And if there's nothing there, that doesn't mean that he has a problem. The problem is we're taking a very small sample of that entire ejaculate from the mucus there. And so the full advantages of the postcoital test as being able as a replacement for a semen analysis really, really falls short. Is it something that could be used and is something that is used frequently? Yes, it is. And can it give us information? Yes. But many people do confuse that this can be done in place of a semen analysis and it does not give you the same information. I don't know if you want me to pause or if you want me to continue with the treatment. Okay, so we'll keep going on. Treatment options. So previously, if there was a male infertility disorder, there was really very little that could be done. What was available was really minuscule. And within the past 20 to 30 years, the availability of options of treatment for the male have essentially exploded. And whenever we're deciding on treatment options, we have to guide them to the underlying problem. And they're going to be selected based on the optimal pregnancy outcome. So certain things include behavioral issues, and that would be what we would find when we do our history. You know, they may not be having frequent enough intercourse. It's not uncommon, particularly with firm couples, that would present to sit there and say that they have intercourse only on Friday nights, 2 times a month. And although that may be adequate in some circumstances, particularly in the setting of infertility, that's really not enough, particularly since the timing may be very much off. There may be aspects of erectile dysfunction. Sex therapy consultation may be necessary if there's problems with an inability to achieve orgasm or premature ejaculation. Like I mentioned, the hormones are the starting point of all of this, and we can actually do blood testing to determine whether or not there are any hormonal abnormalities. And many of those hormonal abnormalities can be directly targeted. Commonly, elevated levels of prolactin are found, and we do have medications. Prolactin is a type of hormone in the pituitary, and we have medications that can change that, those levels and actually improve the functioning subsequently. There's a very common condition in infertile men known as a varicocele. A varicocele is basically an engorged vein that's located around the area of the testes and the scrotum, and approximately half of all infertile men will have some level of varicoceles. Approximately half of these will have normal semen analysis and parameters after they are ligated. Ligation basically consists of either clipping, cutting in some manner, tying. There's non-interventional methods using interventional radiology where you can actually go through the vein and block it using special microcores through the vein itself. And basically, this can be useful. The problem with this is that it does take a little bit of time before the semen analysis parameters normalize. The average is 3 to 6 months, and it could take up to a year. In our patients who are older, if we have someone who's presenting where the clock is ticking, this may not be the most appropriate test for those patients. Electroejaculation, I just mentioned, not something that's typically used frequently, but it is something that is occasionally used. And it's for men who have problems related directly to ejaculation. It could be because of a psychological effect. It could be because of a spinal cord trauma. And basically, they undergo general anesthesia where a probe is placed into the rectum to stimulate the prostate gland from behind and to give electrical impulses to allow ejaculate to be taken out. When one of the problems is related to a blockage, then we do have methods available to us whereby we can cut out the section of the blockage, depending on where it is, using microsurgical techniques, and reconnect the area where the blockage existed. And these tend to be very successful in those specific circumstances. They're most commonly used in patients who've had vasectomies before, but they can be used in various other circumstances where there may be a blockage that is presented. And then, if I can get this to work for you guys real quickly. So, testicular sperm, basically what you do is, in this circumstance, you can actually take a biopsy of the tissue of the testes itself. And what you see in this picture here is right over here, that's actually tissue from the testes itself. And what is going to happen, and you're going to see in a second, is they're agitating the tissue to try to draw a specific sperm, one sperm cell, a spermatozoa, out. And what you just saw over there, you see right here, here's the head and here's the tail of the sperm. Using these microscopic techniques, they're able to actually draw the sperm up out of the tissue itself. So whereas normally it used to be required to have the sperm actually developed and in the epididymis, in the vas deferens, in order to access it, we're able to actually access the sperm at a much earlier stage through a testicular biopsy. These are just some of the methods that we do have available. There are other things, and like I said, this is a talk that could be exhaustive in the content and scope of it. At this point, I'm going to turn over to Rav Neuberger to discuss some of the halachic implications. We'll have a chance for questions at the end of the session.
Thank you very much. And thank you for coming, and the student organization, the Medical Ethics Committee, for giving me the opportunity. And it's a privilege for me to present together with Dr. Chudnov. And one of the blessings that has occurred to our community is that Dr. Mrs. Chudnov moved in. So I have on a regular basis, I can get a tutorial on any aspect of this field of medicine. What I'd like to do is to look at the sugya itself. And I think that if you look at the sugya on which the few lines of Gemara on which almost all of the discussion of the poskim centers on, it'll give us an insight into what are the issues that face Rabbanim and face patients who present, as in this case, test case scenario. So you have the Gemara in front of you, and it's Daf Ayin Vov Med Aleph in Yevamos. Daf Ayin Vov Med Aleph, and here I think I'm going to ask Dr. Chudnov again just to help us understand the Gemara, and we'll see in a moment. And it's a kavod for Dr. Chudnov, myself, to have Rabbi Blau with us as well during this session. The Gemara is focusing on an issue which is unrelated to our topic, and that is an individual where there's a question as to whether one of the anatomical aspects that Dr. Chudnov described are in fact present. And if we usually refer to it as a vas deferens, if one of the anatomical channels is not complete, then a man may be a krus shufcha, and then he may not be able to marry anybody but a giores, or perhaps a mamzeres. And the case in the Gemara is where a person presents to the Rabbanim that they're not sure if the hole in some one of these channels is present. And I'm being vague because we don't fully understand. If we learn the Gemara, it's not clear exactly how our understanding of the anatomy lines up with the Gemara. But the Gemara, apparently, there was a situation where there was a hole, and the hole was in one of these channels and was near the area of the bris. And the Gemara says, well, it depends on the following question. If when the individual ejaculates, if the sperm will leave through this hole and broaden this hole, so then the individual is a krus shufcha, and he can in fact not marry anyone but a gioris or mamzeris. If on the other hand, this individual successfully, the sperm successfully makes its way out through the piatabas, through the urethral opening, then he is he can marry anybody of his choice. So the Gemara says, after presenting this, the second underline, Yilamdeinu Rabbeinu, Heichi Avdina. Now that we know the halacha, so Rava sent to Rav Yosef, how do we work this out? Heicha Avdina, what do we do? So the Gemara presents two options. Option number one is Maisinan Nehoma Chamima Desare. The rectal opening, and that will cause a what we call kishui, that will ultimately lead to ejaculation. And that's how we figure it out. In other words, this person is not married. We want to figure out how we're going to get this person to ejaculate, as far as which would be apparently in a permissible fashion. So the Gemara says, well, there is this technique that apparently will cause some kind of ejaculation. Do you want to comment on this?
The ability for there to be ejaculation without direct stimulation, there is the possibility, and there, you know, what the Gemara describes is the method utilized. Whether or not that specifically would work, and whether that would work for most people, I couldn't tell you for sure. But we do have other methods of indirect
stimulation
and semen extraction. For example, like I showed, the probe that can be placed inside the rectum for electrical stimulation to allow the semen to come out.
Now the Gemara responds by saying, "Otu kuli alma Yaakov Avinu." The Gemara says, is it really so hard to get a semen sample? And it's so hard, everybody's in the level of Yaakov Avinu that we're going to have to stimulate them in a indirect fashion. The Gemara says, no, we should bring Mavirin kame big date savonin. We should bring colorful clothing. In other words, we should allow the person to have what we would call a sexual fantasy, and that should bring about the ability to procure a sample. And the Gemara says, well, is everybody Barzilai Agaloni? Is everybody living with this, with that kind of attention and so easily excited? So the Gemara says, you're right. It's better to go with the barley bread. That's what we should do. Right, that's the sugya. When looking at the sugya, the Gemara is handing us a very significant chiddush, a very significant insight. And that's what we have to focus on. The insight of this Gemara is that on the other side of the page, you have the Gemara Nida Daf Yud Gimel. And Nida Daf Yud Gimel, that is the primary source where Chazal tell us how strict, how concerned we are about being motzi shichvas zera levatola, about having a wasteful seminal emission. One of the svarim point out that it's always called shichvas zera because, as Dr. Chudnov pointed out, the zera is always accompanied by seminal fluid. So the shichva is that layer and that medium in which the zera is found. The Gemara says in Nida Daf Yud Gimel that a person who has a wasteful seminal discharge is chayiv misa, that he is considered to be a sheifech damim, he's considered to be a murderer. He is likened to a person who serves avodah zarah. The Gemara has, on the second side, you give him a base, the Gemara says that the Dor HaMabul, we read about on Shabbos, they were held responsible for being motzi zera levatola, for being wasteful with seminal emission. So on one hand, you have a Gemara that says this is one of the strictest halachas. Shulchan Aruch writes that the avera, the sin of having a wasteful seminal emission, is amongst the most severe averas. And it's likened, and there's a discussion in the Rishonim as whether it's an Issa Deiraisa, an Issa Derabbanan. Is it a Deiraisa? Because the Gemara says that a person is chayav misa, he gets a death penalty if he has a motzi zera levatola. On the other hand, we're hard pressed to find a pasuk that says it's osir. We go back to Dor HaMavol. So either way, you need not go into it right now. It's probably a discussion amongst the Rishonim, whether it's an Issa Deiraisa, an Issa Derabbanan. But either way, in these situations where the Gemara describes that it's a very, very significant issue, so whether it's a Rabbanan or Deiraisa, it doesn't matter to us. The Gemara says that it's very severe. The Gemara is willing to say it's so severe that it's likened to Avodah Zarah, likened to Shvichas Damim. So however you take the Gemara, it's a serious issue. And Shulchan Aruch says one of the most significant averas. So now a person presents, and the approach of medicine is to say, well, let's get a semen analysis. Let's look at the semen. But the only way you can look at the semen is by having a person violate what would seem to be a very serious avera. So that's the tension that a patient presenting in this way presents as well to the doctor. Now, therefore, this Gemara comes in. This Gemara says that we do semen analysis. We will, for the purpose of figuring out whether this person can marry or not, who they can marry, we're willing to have the person ejaculate and look at the semen. So it would sound like we have a Gemara here that tells us it's mutter, it's not a problem. That's very much debated amongst the Achronim. How do we move from this Gemara? And two issues are raised. One issue is raised is whether we can compare semen analysis for the purpose of procreation to semen analysis for the purpose of marriage. The Gemara is clear that we can do semen analysis to determine whom this person should marry. Is that a natural carryover to the issue of procreation? This was much debated. Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote, it's a davar poshut. It's a kal v'chomer. If, he says, this person can marry a geyoris, he can marry a mzeris, he wants to marry somebody else. So allowing a person to marry the person of his choice, that is should be a lesser tzarech, a lesser need than helping a couple of children, being the kind of superior rivia. So if the Gemara says we can do semen analysis, we can express, we can ejaculate semen for the purpose of helping this person find his mate, and he has other choice, we should certainly be allowed to do it in our case as well. Prior to Rav Moshe Feinstein, one of the great poskim of pre-war Europe, the Divrei Malkiel, Rav Malkiel Tenenbaum was the Rav in Lomja, and he is one of the major sources in this whole area because he dealt with it in several tshuvas. He thought otherwise. He thought that one could argue that the mitzvah of Pirvei Ribya, he says, we know so little. And this is why it was so important to hear the entire medical presentation, because it shapes how you look at this tshuva. He says, number one, we know so little about male infertility. He doesn't use these terms. But he says, the chances of looking at the sperm and finding a solution, what are the chances? We'll look at the sperm, we'll be the same place we were before. He says, and his understanding is it's primarily always female infertility which causes the problem. So he says, what are we going to accomplish? And he's not sure whether the need to have children, because he's not mechuyev, he's mechuyev to get married. He's mechuyev to try to have children, but he's not mechuyev to go for all of the various requirements, the entire workup that's beyond the call of the mitzvah. We do it because we want to make the mitzvah, we want to have children. So the Divrei Malkiel is not sure whether you can go from that Gemara and say, all semen analysis mutter, even in the case of procreation. The Divrei Malkiel points out how big a chiddush this Gemara is, because Chazal have gone to great extent that a person should not be motzis there, a person should not have a wasteful sexual mission. The Gemara says a person should sleep in a certain way, a person should watch what he thinks about. So he said, you see how concerned Chazal are, we have to be very, very conservative in expanding this Gemara. So that's the first issue. The next issue which the Achronim discuss is, did in fact the Gemara give such a big license as we think? Because the Gemara only allowed what we would call secondary ejaculation. The Gemara allowed, the Gemara calls what the Achronim called geroma. We allowed the person to do something that would then create an excitation and allow them to be Moses there, right? But we didn't, that's what the Divrei Malkiel argues. He argues we didn't allow anything more than that. We didn't allow anything, any what's called mishmush b'idayim, any kind of physical techniques to try to create ejaculation. So maybe we allow the person to look and create a fantasy. Maybe we allow the person to apply a hot compress to a certain area. But anything more than that, which would be necessary, as the doctor explained, that the chances of us getting a good semen analysis from putting hot barley loaves in the rectal area is not going to be great. Even the chances of having hihurim may not be great. We're going to have to require certain much more definitive protocols. So that's what the Divrei Malkiel ends by saying. He's not sure at all if we should allow direct stimulation, hand stimulation, in order to procure the semen. In this debate enters a very important source by the Beis Shmuel. The Beis Shmuel is one of the major commentaries on Shulchan Aruch and predated everything we mentioned until now, predated the Divrei Malkiel and certainly Rav Moshe Feinstein. And the Beis Shmuel says that because of this Gemara, he was willing to expand it to the following case. Sometimes a woman will present to a Rav a question whether she's in need or not. She found some kind of blood and maybe something than a probe. So the Beis Shmuel says, we're not sure whether the blood comes from the woman or maybe it comes from the husband in the course of relations. So the Beis Shmuel says, well, you see from this Gemara, you're allowed to look at the semen to see whether the blood's coming from the husband. So let's do a semen analysis to see if there's blood in the semen. The Beis Shmuel at the end says, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if you can move from this Gemara to his case. So once again, you see that on one hand, we seem to have a text that indicates we should be allowed to do semen analysis and procure it in a direct fashion. And then there was a hesitation by the Beis Shmuel whether we can compare the two cases and whether we can allow ourselves the right to do, let's say, hand stimulation, direct stimulation. So when we look at this Gemara, at first glance it sounds like it's a winner Gemara. It gives us what we need. It gives us a mako. And Rabbi Moshe Feinstein writes without any question. You also see the clarity of Rav Moshe's approach. Rav Moshe writes, the Gemara clearly says it is mutter, and he leaves it at that. He goes on to discuss another point that we'll discuss in a moment. On the other hand, say, Rav Chaim Moiser Grudzinski, the Rav of Vilna, he takes the Divrei Malkiel's hesitations very seriously. There, he points out, Rav Yaakov Emden, various limiter of Moshe Feinstein, hundreds of years before, says the Gemara clearly says it's mutter letzorech mitzvah. That's Rav Emden ends it and says a line in his tshuva. Semen analysis letzorech mitzvah is mutter. So once again, so that's where that would indicate, and with no hesitation. Rav Chaim Moiser, because of the hesitation, because we're not sure, can you expand this Gemara to our case? So he is lenient based on two other reasons. One reason is that there is a Tosfos that says that it is permissible to ejaculate ba'ofen akroy, to do it in a happenstance from time to time, as long as there's no intent to avoid having children. There's a Tosfos that says, it's a minority view in Tosfos, that says that the iser of being motzi zera is if a person intends to avoid having children. That position, it doesn't make it to the Ramah. And even though later Achrodim, the Chalkim Chokik on the spot says we should not in any way practice along the lines of this one line in the Ramah, this one Tosfos, and many Achrodim point this out, take a very severe attitude towards this Tosfos. Nevertheless, Chaim Moiser says, but it is a position in Tosfos. And here we have a couple that's trying to have children and want to figure out what's going on, so we should consider that. We should also consider Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger in the Oroch HaNer. So he points out that the Iser is to waste semen. And he goes further to say that there's a position in Tosfos that says the prohibition of wasting semen is the prohibition of not producing children, using semen not to produce children. Never, if, however, I'm using semen in any way at all, this is the Oroch HaNer's expansion, in any way at all to procure children, then it should not be a violation of Otzoh Zer Levatola. So Chaim Moiser says these are two, we'd call them minority views, based on two minority views in Tosfos. One, that ejaculation, which is not for the purpose of avoiding having children, can be permitted in a happenstance, once in a while situation. And a fertility workup in the course of life, I think, would satisfy that. And another minority view, also from the Balei Tosfos, which would lead us to say, in the course of trying to have children, should be permissible. It's not called Hatzos Zera Labatola. So again, where are we at right now? We have a Gemara that says, semen analysis, ejaculation is permissible. Let's call it Tzarech Mitzvah. There's a question as to whether we can expand it to every Tzarech Mitzvah. A question, can we expand it to every form of procuring semen? Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Rabbi Yaakov Emden said, be careful of here. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein said, yes, but, and we'll explain the but in a moment. And Rabbi Chaim Moiser equivocated, but permitted it for other reasons. Okay. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein now comes back to the Gemara. And this is the second piece that we have to look at very carefully. Rabbi Moshe says, when you look at the Gemara, what was so difficult? Why did Rava send to Rabbi Yosef, Yilamdeinu Rabbeinu Eichei Abdinan? What did, we knew the Gemara Nida says that there are ways of procuring semen. Semen, the Gemara says, it's terribly awesome. So the Gemara said, we have to procure semen. So what is this difficulty? Rav had to go to Rabbi Yosef and say, Yilamdeinu Rabbeinu, hey, how do we do this? Rabbi Yosef said, how do we do this? Everybody knows how to procure semen. Right? So Rav Moshe says, it must mean that there's some other issue which we haven't articulated yet. Here Rav Moshe has the Chiddush. It's the Chiddush which we can find in the Yam Shel Shloma. Rav Moshe developed this entirely on his own. He said, there must be another prohibition, and that is the prohibition of procuring semen in a direct, with hand massaging or other kinds of direct massaging. The most obvious way to procure semen, Rav Moshe says, is also. What's the basis? There's a Gemara Nida Dafid Gimel Beis that says that out of the Iser of Loisinof, Rabbi Yishmol says, Loitehei bar niyof bein biyad bein beregel. A person should not be a menoyf, should not have an inappropriate, it would sound like an inappropriate sexual activity, even if it's done with one's hand or with one's foot. So Rabbi Moshe says that apparently that's what bothered the Gemara. The Gemara said that a hand massage or any other kind of physical direct massaging that would lead to procuring semen should be an Iser Deiraisa. And apparently this Gemara said, we're willing to negotiate the Iser of Atzoa Zer Levatola. We are not willing to negotiate the Iser of Leisinov. Yilamdeinu Rabbeinu, hey, what are we going to do over here? There's an Iser of Leisinov. Apparently that was not budgetly. They wouldn't budge that then. So Rav Moshe goes on to explain that whereas he would permit procuring the semen indirectly, and from this Gemara, the one red line he would have is not through mishmush yad, not through hand massaging. Rav Chaim Oizer did not learn this chiddush of Rav Moshe, because he indicates be a dime would be permissible. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach points out that the Yam Shel Shlomo was sensitive to Rav Moshe's chiddush, and Yam Shel Shlomo preferred to have some kind of indirect procuring of semen. But again, the bottom line is he would permit even be a dayan. So now let's go to the next step. Now is, so, halacha lamasa. An individual comes, the case presentation that Dr. Chadner presented to us. They come and the approach of medicine now is, let us get a semen analysis. As Dr. Chadner pointed out, direct information, it's easy, is no, it's cheap, there's no invasive procedures. If we were to proceed with female workup, so that has to be after the initial ovulatory testing, everything else is invasive. Everything else requires some kind of difficulty. The approach of Al Rabbanim till recently was, do as much as he can of a female workup before you have to negotiate a male workup. Why? You see that we have to negotiate the halacha of Hatzos Zera Levatola. It's an Iser Chomer, it's a very strict din. Rav Waldenberg formulates this, after you've done as much as you can done with a female workup, then move to the male workup. Recently, in the last, I'm not sure exactly, from my experience, the last 15 years, doctors are very hesitant. Non-Orthodox doctors are very hesitant to move in that course. If it's unfair, why are we doing invasive procedures on a woman when we can easily first, right? The numbers now is an equal amount of infertility. This was not the common approach of Rabbanim 20 years ago, 30 years ago. We were not aware that male infertility is such a number, and we weren't aware that we could accomplish, right? So things have changed dramatically. Number one, we're much more aware of male infertility. As the doctor explained, there are more options now for treating male infertility, so there's much greater value and much less emotional cost in getting a semen analysis. And that's the issue which now is al shulchan malachim, comes up to Rabbanim now. Can we proceed with the semen analysis before we have exhausted bothering, and it's very uncomfortable, and it may even take a greater emotional toll on a woman to undergo a fertility workup than to get a semen analysis for the man. For the man, it's one test, and for a woman, it could be numerous visits and numerous procedures. Before we go, that's the reason why it requires readdressed by Rabbanim as to whether we should shift to advocating or allowing a semen analysis at an earlier part of the workup than Orthodox Jews used to have in previous years. Before we follow up on that, let me just explain, now that we know that there are different ways of procuring the semen, so let me explain how Halacha addresses that. In other words, Rav Moshe says one should not be doing a physical massage. On the other hand, Rav Moshe is very, very permissible if you don't use a physical massage. So what are our options? Rav Chaim Moiser was permissible, permitted ejaculation based on two positions that were not widely accepted. He says we have to help out the infertile couple. But if we can find ways in which Rav Chaim Moiser would say, we don't have to negotiate the Tzor Zero Tov to the same extent, he would be much happier as well. And all the posts who are makil and allow semen analysis is always b'mokam atzorach, when there's a need. Maybe if we could avoid the need of being motzi zera levatola, we shouldn't try to do so. So therefore, the post-coital approach is the one that is favored by all of Rabbanim. Even going back to the Divrei Malkiel, who was very strict about being motzi zera levatola, he said that a post-coital approach would be permissible. They have to be very careful because some permit it because they thought it was the sort of a panacea. I'll explain that in a moment. The Divrei Malkiel points out, though, two very important sources. He says it has to be permissible to take a post-coital sample. How does he argue this? He says, well, there is a halacha that when a woman prepares herself for going to mikveh, when she prepares herself for going to mikveh, there's a halacha we don't practice nowadays for other reasons, to remove any kind of zerek. And that's not halacha lamasa nowadays. By the time a woman goes to mikveh, she's far from ever being with her husband. But in the days of Tum and Tara, it was not so uncommon. But there's another din, that if there is any possibility that there is a residual seminal discharge in the vaginal area, so one cannot begin counting the Shiva Nikim. Our practice is to wait several days. We wait 5 days before we begin the counting of 7 days. There was a suggestion by Rishonim to simply wash out the area and get rid of any residual seminal discharge that's there. So the Divrei Malkiel says, apparently you see that you're allowed to remove seminal discharge, what we would call a post-coital removal. You're allowed to do that when there's a significant tzarach. So we can certainly argue, as the Divrei Malkiel argues, that to treat infertility should be a greater tzarach than getting a woman to begin the Shiva Nikiyam a little bit earlier. There's a debate amongst the Achronim as to whether this is a correct interpretation of that halacha. Nevertheless, the argument seems to be a strong argument, and therefore, almost all poskim would say, Rav Moshe writes this, and the Rav Oldenburg writes this, that if we can have a post-coital analysis, that would be the ideal. doctors who are not orthodox are very hesitant, as Dr. Chanov pointed out, because whereas you get one piece of information you may not get from samples that are pure samples, you get some information as to the connection and the mixing of husband and wife, but it doesn't tell you that much. Right? Nevertheless, as we've discussed privately, the post-coital sample becomes very important for the Orthodox couple because it gives enough information that would then justify doing a straight semen analysis. In other words, let's say the post-coital analysis comes back with pure motility, poor motility, or poor numbers. Right? So then it's easy for a Rav to say, let's get more information about the husband's semen instead of doing invasive work on the woman. So here it's a relative, from a halachic perspective, it seems to be mutter to do a post-coital analysis, right? And it will certainly give us some information, which halachically is very important. Medically, it may not be so important. I've discussed with many, many doctors. Nevertheless, halachically, it would give us, number one, should we pursue a varicocele, right? If the doctor notices a varicocele, so postcoital will give us information as to whether we should bother doing it. If the numbers are very, very good, maybe we wouldn't proceed that way. So that's a value for us in doing a postcoital analysis, again, which a doctor who's sensitive to the Orthodox concerns and halakhic concerns would then be more forthcoming than a doctor who really does not see the appropriateness of postcoital analysis when it's so much easier to get information in a much more direct fashion. Rav Moshe Feinstein does point out that there's one issue with postcoital analysis, and that is that he says sometimes it means that the couple has to be together in the doctor's office. Sometimes because of the neighborhood where the doctor is in, there are no motels or hotels nearby, the speed with which he has to get the... And Rav Moshe says, then it's not worth it. He says it's such a violation of privacy, of tznius, that it's not worth getting a postcoital analysis if it means being together in such in a way which violates a person's privacy. If we take the next step and we have to get an analysis and the postcoital does not give us, for example, either the doctor is totally unwilling to do it or we have in fact exhausted the process with one's wife, or the postcoital analysis came back and it's worrisome, right? Or perhaps, as the doctor mentioned to me privately, maybe do a hormonal analysis, do a blood workup, and the hormonal analysis comes back and gives us reason to be concerned that maybe the sperm is not developing properly because the appropriate hormones are down. So that would also be a reason to say, we've done the blood work, we see that there is reason to be concerned about the semen, so instead of now doing a full workup on one's wife, let's do a workup on the semen. So then the question, how do we procure the semen? So here the post can arrange it in the following way. The preference would be to use the condom that Dr. Tudden referred to before. And the reason for preferring the condom is the condom would be first. Next would be called Dosh Bifnim Vizor Bimchutz, is the couple to be together. And then to withdraw before ejaculation, and then to ejaculate into a test tube. The next appropriate way is for the husband and wife to be together, not having relations, but Bekir of Boser, they should be together with intimacy, and the entire process of ejaculating should be into a test tube. And finally is to try through excitation, and then if necessary, even the remotion would not allow this, to do hand massaging. The last two become necessary when we are procuring semen for IVF, because IVF always has to be done, almost always I think, when a woman has not yet gone to mikveh. So the first three approaches of using a condom, of being together with relations, or with intimacy without relations, so that is not possible if we are trying to procure semen for the purpose of inserting it into one's wife with an IUI or IVF, because again, at that time, the woman is often not yet back from mikveh, and that'll often be a detail which one has to work out with the rav. So in that situation, we'll only be able to do either through hirhurim, through sexual fantasy, or biyadayim. Again, and Rav Moshe would not permit the last option, but as we said, Shlomo Zalman and other poskim seem to permit it. The preference of the condom is that there is a preference to having relations as natural as possible. And the reason for that is because there are many poskim and some rishonim who indicate that hotzah zera levatola, there's a discussion we can't go into it right now as to how to define the prohibition of hotzah zera levatola. Some define it as wasting semen that will not end up in procreation. And some define it as having an unnatural relations with one's wife. So therefore, this is primarily based on the approach of Rav Chaim Oizer. Rav Chaim Oizer explained to us, he understands, his position was that relations that are unnatural, that's a violation of Otsar or Levatola. But if they're natural, then they're not a violation. Rav Chaim Oizer was the individual and the odd man out who found some room for permitting the use of a condom in the situation where if a woman would conceive, it would be dangerous for her. So he would permit a condom, and based on this approach, because he said, well, in this kind of a situation, it's entirely normal and natural to have relations with a condom. Rav Moshe argues strongly that he doesn't accept this position of Rav Chaim Moser. Nevertheless, for the purpose of procuring semen, for the purpose of analysis, and ultimately for the concern of fertility, there Rav Moshe said, since Rav Chaim Moser says, I don't agree with it, but Rav Chaim Moser said it, so therefore it becomes an approach that he thinks is next best after a post-coital situation. And then the next Rav Moshe says, if we cannot use a condom, then we call to interrupt relations and to withdraw and to be motzi zera. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach seemed to prefer being together intimately without relations over either the condom or being dosh b'fnim zera michutz, because he seems to say it's the way that Nishma Sefram quotes him, he did not write it himself, because he seems to say the idea of withdrawing and actively taking zera away from one's wife, he found that to be more an aberration and more a violation of hotzah zera levatola than to be entirely outside of one's wife and to procure the semen in that way. So again, as a summary of what we said, we pointed out that the way that Rabbanim approach this is through the lens of the Gemara and Yevamos Ayin Vav. The Gemara and Ayin Vav seems to indicate there are grounds for procuring semen. The Gemara then goes on to say, then we have to figure out whether that situation is similar enough to our situation. That's where the post can disagree as to whether it is or not. Rav Moshe is saying it's similar enough, permissible, and others saying that we have to equivocate and hesitate and perhaps find other ways of procuring the semen. Rav Moshe takes a strong view that hand massaging and similar massaging is absolutely awesome and founds no grounds for leniency based on the same Gemara. And other poskim did not learn the Gemara in that way, did not stress this line of Heichi Abdinan. So therefore, our approach is to negotiate. It often happens in halacha. We arrange our preferences. We prefer to use post-coital, then to use a condom, and then to use what's called the interrupting relations, and then the other forms of direct sperm procurement. And all of this is in the context of whether of how much we pursue the male fertility workup in the absence of a female fertility workup. So we can take a few moments for questions, I think.
I actually just wanted to show quickly, while we're taking questions, you can watch. What you're actually viewing over here is the fertilization of an egg. And what you'll notice in a second as it gets into focus, all the little things that are moving around the big thing in the center are the semen.
And as you can see, the quantity of the semen is actually fairly important in this circumstance, as it's trying to eat its way through the shell, the zona pellucida of the egg, to try to be the winner to go in and fertilize the egg.
And then, once the sperm makes it in?
Once the sperm makes it in, it shuts down the wall and basically hardens the shell so that no other sperm are capable of making it into the egg for fertilization.
Is it never possible
for two sperms to get inside? In rare circumstances, it does occur, yes.
What happens
then? You end up with an abnormal chromosomal pregnancy. Depending on what the chromosomes are that make it in, it would be an abnormal pregnancy. I'm sorry? It depends. Yes, there are what's known as not directly a trisomy, but where there's a full duplication, an extra set of chromosomes. But yes, they can make it the full time sometimes. Yes. Yes, there are many men who are born with only one testes. The question was, is one testes enough to be able to get a woman pregnant? And yes, it is. As long as that one testes is functioning, frequently people have various conditions that require removal of one of the testes, and it's still perfectly functional.
And I assume there's no difference in the right and the left, medically?
Medically, there's no different right and left.
And if one is damaged, like Moch v'chosus, does that affect in any way the other one? Presumably not. So we can we say in the Gemara of Chris Shofcha, if one testes is damaged, and therefore the Gemara assumes that he's infertile? Any way of explaining that?
The way that it may be possible to explain is that if there is an injured testes in there that's causing an abnormal functioning of the hormonal levels, again, we're talking about theoretical cases, it could potentially affect the overall fertility potential if it's causing an abnormal production of hormones, or if it's producing antibodies.
Just wondering if you're in an area where you can't go to a different doctor and they're not a firm doctor or whatever and it'll be impossible for you to find a different one, is it possible ever, in terms of Mishum Eva, to go through with the sperm analysis if you're going to make such a Chilul Hashem? All these doctors in the practice are saying, what's wrong with these Jews? They won't do these, you know, regular sperm analysis. They want to go through every other option with the woman, and it's pointless.
Then that might give us the motivation, the reason to justify for a full male workup. But the real answer to your question is that one cannot look at it, it's not the context that's it. We cannot look at the Chil Hashem. For us to present what Halacha wants us to do, that's the Kiddush Hashem. A person would definitely understand that. So we have to work harder explaining it. Right? But you can never say that if, in fact, understanding is, and as far as Allah is concerned, it is inappropriate to do a certain workup, so then we have to work harder explaining it, but not shrink back by saying, then I can understand this. If it's quite a different position, understand things differently, do work harder.
And if I could just say from the point of view of the physician, in those circumstances, it might be helpful to have the Rav that you're in consultation with speak to the doctor. Most doctors will speak to the Rav itself to have a better understanding of the issues at play. And it might help for the communication purposes, even if it's someone who knows nothing, to allow that. As a matter of fact, many physicians will actually welcome that.
I'd like to thank Dr. Chudnov and Rabbi Neuberger for being here with us this afternoon. The time is now 3:10. At 3:35, we'll be starting the next session in Lamport Auditorium. There will be light refreshments in the meantime. Dr. Chudnov and Rabbi Neuberger will be available for a few more questions now.
If anyone has any concerns or any questions, by all means, you can get in contact with me. I welcome any comments or questions. My email address is scott@chudnov.com, so it's very easy to get in contact with me.
The next session will be in Hebrew. There will be translation headsets in front of Lamport Auditorium. If you would like a headset, there will be a form to fill out. And we please ask you to head over now.